Paid off. That's the state senator of Pennsylvania. the Senate has passed a bill to make the firefly, or the lightning bug, the state's official insect. The idea started with the Highland Park Elementary School third grade class. Senator said, the firefly. You know what the state's insect of New York really should be? If you want an insect that is really classically typical of New York, it has to be the cockroach. Absolutely. And we'd be the first state to stop fighting cockroaches and just go along with it, right? Let's get a couple of these commercials out of the way first. 5 foot 2, 5 foot 3. Listen, one more question that just has come in from one of our listeners. I promised to myself that I would not at any point any longer mention streaking. Everybody, you know, streaking seems to be such a drag. Now, that can be interpreted several ways, but streaking has become, you know, everybody touched with me. But this is a question that I just could not ignore. It says, dear Mr. Shepherd, would you please give me some suggestions for creative streaking? Creative is the key word there, of course. Just running out and running through the weeds and jumping over, you know, a Volkswagen and cutting like hell through the fraternity house is not exactly creative. It just, you know, just takes a lot of good legwork. Now, the interesting point is that this was signed by a girl. Now, and her point is well taken. I think creativity is possible in almost any art form, and in any activity. One can be a creative duster if one dusts well in the house. Just put a little, you know, little creative legwork and some beautiful wrist action. You can even dust to, say, the sounds of the Swan Lake Ballet. And dusting then becomes something that people would pay money to come in to see you do, right? It would be worthwhile. Right? And a thing must have its own value as a creative subject. You know, the idea that you have brought something creative to your work should be payment in itself. Now, since the question has arisen, is there such a thing as creative streaking, and is it possible? Yes, it is possible. For example, anyone who has ever attended what used to be known as a Burley house, you know, has seen some pretty creative streaking in his time. And I would like to suggest, since you're a girl, there is a great act that was a streaker, very highly paid streaking act, in which tassels of various colors were attached to certain portions of the anatomy. A creative streaker who could get those tassels twirling in opposite directions as she streaked could very well get herself on the Johnny Carson show. If she knows a little bit about, you know, have you seen that time? Then there was another great streaker who did not use tassels, but used small sequin-covered propellers attached to certain prominent portions of her anatomy. And by moving in certain artistic directions, using the muscles well, she could get her propellers going in two different directions. And so I would like to suggest there's all kinds of possibilities. I don't want to. Then there's, of course, the psychedelic streak, in which a person can streak in various colors. Now, this is it depends on how well the color they use as to whether it's artistic or not. Then there's the commercial streak. For example, it wouldn't be too difficult for you to go about town and get sponsors for your streak, carrying in certain parts of your anatomy a small advertisement for various things that are obtainable in the commercial market. For example, it wouldn't be too difficult, I imagine, to get a few massage parlors to sponsor your streak. And, you know, if you like this, try, you know. So everything has its value. So would you please, Al, once more, I want to clear the air here just before we go into the crime and punishment segment of tonight's work. That's kind of obvious. Yeah, we just handle it for quick, but it's 5 foot 10. I just mean, oh, what a, yeah. Has anybody seen my tail? Oh, I know some lyrics here right at this point. Has anybody seen my tail? A little bit higher there. Now Has anybody seen my dear? Hold it there, hold it there. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. We have an adult audience here. Let's put it this way, an adult nervous audience. As is the case with everybody these days. Which brings up, once again, we must remind you that the subject of tonight's program is crime and punishment.
All right, everybody, let's dance.
That's right. And you better start dancing or I'm going to shoot your feet right off. Good. This is WOR New York, speaking of crime and punishment. 5'15". Has anyone ever seen my little gal of mine? Used to be called Charlie. And I'll call you Charlotte, 5'2", eyes are blue. Oh, well, you know, I'm making no value judgment. I'm just saying, you know, it's all part of the swirling, exciting life of the maelstrom of our times. One never knows what's happening, does one? Does one. No? Does one? Oh, yes, crime and punishment. Okay. So I was going to lose that, didn't you? One does not ever lose retribution. It's always with you. Yes, crime and punishment. Have you ever been actually caught at a terrible moment when you had just begun to or were about to commit a crime? Have you? Now, it depends on what you call crime. Crime means doing something that is illicit, illegal, in the society, the situation in which you find yourself at that time. You have to be very careful. Today's crime may be tomorrow's heroic act. That's right. If you notice already now, they're beginning to, as people get more and more disillusioned in our time, now they're beginning to reevaluate Benedict Arnold. He'll come off, listen, he'll come off a hero. George Washington is going to be the ultimate think eventually. So you never know, you know. History is a sneaky mother, I'll tell you. But what is crime? You know, it's very difficult to know what crime is. We don't know. Is there an ultimate crime? Well, we don't know even about that. You don't know, you know. Can you imagine yourself arriving before this imaginary great bar of justice? And, you know, you think you've lived a totally clean life. You haven't done anything. Right? And, you've lived an exemplary life by earthly standards. And you arrive up before this great bar of justice. Yeah. How you got there, well, that's another story. Nevertheless, there's a great swoosh, and you go down the chute, and whoop, like that, and can you imagine going to heaven like being sent to one of those pneumatic tubes that they have? You ever seen the old department stores? There's still a lot of them around where they put this little round piece of metal, a little tin can, they put your money in it, they stick it in this chute, it goes, and it goes, see? And you wait around, and all of a sudden it goes, and the change comes back. Well, I have it. From the time I was a kid, I always wondered, it's a mysterious thing, you know. I've often thought of heaven, or going to heaven or hell, as being sucked down a giant pneumatic tube. And you land there. You're unwrapped. And there you are. You're before the bar of justice. Now, you're not in heaven nor hell. You ain't nowhere yet. You're in the, you know, you're at the place where they decide where you're going to get assigned. Here's this cosmic judge, and he's looking down from this giant pearl-covered desk. Somehow we always relate pearl to heaven, don't we? Mother of pearl. You know, I don't know why. I mean, you never think of a desk as, say, a tasteful shade of burnt orange with a cocoa trimming, anything like that. It's always a mother of pearl or white somehow, you know? But nevertheless, here he is. He's up there on top of that desk, and he's looking down at you. And we always see him as an elderly citizen, right? With a giant beard, and he looks down. And the little echo chamber wouldn't hurt here, Al. We're preparing our heavenly voice. Charles W. Fuller, You have arrived at the bar of justice. The time has come for you to settle all your earthly debts and to be assigned for all eternity to your just reward. Shall you go to heaven or shall you go the other direction? I am now opening the vast book of accounts to see just how you did when you were living at 1722 and a half Murgatroyd Avenue in the Bronx, New York, New York. Stand up straight, Charles W. Bullard, pulling your gut, please. You must listen now to your eternal sentence. Aha! I have rarely seen a page covered with such an incredible pastiche of crime. There is no doubt where you're going. What? Crime? What do you mean, crime? That's the problem, friends. Are you at this moment, this very instant, guilty of a crime just by listening to me? You could be. Who knows? There have been those who have said that Shepherd is the ultimate subversive, rotting away the core of the brain, which is even more subversive than rotting away the laws, rotting away the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, rotting away the core of your brain, suggesting perhaps that you going in there tomorrow and writing that commercial for the pickle company could very well be committing a heinous crime against all of mankind that you may damn well pay for, floating along the river Styx there, blowing that Baltimore canoe as the flames lap up at your old bottom and the screaming dead souls yell and holler and try to make it up to the shore. They never quite make it because Charon keeps bopping them on the head with a cast iron paddle. Not that dee-dee-dee-dee. I suppose I have to teach each other. Oh, yeah, crime and punishment. You want to know about that? Well, all right. We've seen it, haven't we? We've seen the face of the defendants. That's one thing that television brings you in all the time. It brings you some guy constantly up before a gigantic inquisition, admitting his guilt. This is probably the most common thing we've seen on television recently. It's replaced all the great old shows, you know, Pinky Lee, all them shows. Remember Pinky Lee? You do? You remember the hat? Pinky Lee, I'm Pinky Lee. And, this is all part of our culture. You can't put it down. But nevertheless, the sight of... I'm being a surrogate for you. Every man today likes to feel that he is an innocent person. He is being accused by an unjust society of various acts against the common weal. This is probably a perpetual feeling that malefactors have always felt. Very few malefactors admit that they were wrong. No way. Absolutely. They were driven to it by factors above which and about which they had no control. Well, I was one time, and I sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, I wake up in a quiet sweat, really a sweat, thinking what happens is any criminal, any time that the crime has been perpetrated, the desire of the criminal to talk about his victory is almost impossible to fight down. I mean, if you have pulled a fantastic job, and the back of your car, the trunk of your 53 Dodge, is filled with $20 bills right up to the top, and you open up the trunk and they fly out, you've got 27 million $20 bills in the back. It's not easy to prevent yourself, you know, some night when you're down at the Bluebird Tavern, you got a couple of wild turkeys under your belt there. To say, well, God, you know, you're watching up the TV in the corner there, and you see these guys getting caught by Jack Lord and by Cannon and all those guys. Say, look, did I ever tell you guys that? You guys ever wonder why I light my cigars with $20 bills, huh? Yes, the desire to talk about your crime is a terrible, terrible compulsion. In fact, novels have been written about this. What do you think Crime and Punishment was about? Well, I mean, Raskolnikov, he could not, ultimately, he had to say, I did it, you guys, come and take me away. Well, why? Nobody knows why. It's one of those things, because crime is a form of competition. And competition, yes, it is. And you're competing against the system. And you're taking a long bet. And most times you lose. But those rare moments when you win, a solitary, unsung victory is just simply not much of a victory at all. I mean, can you imagine what it would be like if you broke the world record for the 880? Absolutely broke the absolutely known world record for the 880, and nobody knew about it. And you knew. That would not be hard to keep in some ways. And on the other hand, you could not help spelling it, right? Okay. I discovered this very early in my career. I have to suggest right here now that one of the best educational, perhaps, devices, I think it should be written into every kid's education, is to be caught red-handed at a specific point in his life early enough so that it's a total trauma. And for that, from that day onward, he will be very, very careful. I have a feeling that a lot of guys that are getting caught in the big dragnet today have never been caught in any dragnet. You can't imagine, say, Ehrlichman getting caught off base in the third grade. He looks like a natural-born good speller. Haldeman looks like this guy can do algebra till hell freezes over, doesn't he? Well, so, you know, you get to a certain point, and you don't think in terms of yourself getting caught at anything. Whereas those of us who are caught early in our career think of ourselves constantly in terms of being caught. Once you've been burned by that stark flame of retribution, once you have been part of a system where the axe is lowered on the back of your neck for an evil crime you have perpetrated and were caught right into that, you are different. I'm the kind of guy who drives through the byways of New Jersey at 5 o'clock in the morning, at dawn, when there's no other car in the road, will stop for a red light. There's no car within 500 miles. I'll stop. Why? Instinct. That's right, because how am I to know that that red light over there is not a cleverly disguised New Jersey state cop with a red light on the top of his head, you know? I mean, after all, I've been taken once. Yes, it's the disguise that gets you. You know what happened to me? All right, I'll tell you the story. In high school, sophomore year, that's the time you start to go wrong. When you're a freshman, you're a little scared. I'm a sophomore, and I'm kind of feeling kind of great. Next year, I'm going to be a junior. Springtime, sap rising. Yes, I was already beginning to put out little shoots around the back of my ears. A nest of robins was circling over my head. They were about to start a little nesty there. It was spring, you know. Nest of robins, sap rises, a little bit, you know. The lute string of passion and desire was playing deep in my gut. And this was also affecting certain friends of mine. Schwartz, namely, in this particular case. For some reason or other, Flick totally escaped this dragnet. He was not even involved that day, which was highly unusual because he was the leading criminal when I sacked. And it was a sect. But on this particular occasion, we went to big high schools here, tremendous high school, 3,000 kids. And it was a beautiful day. Now, we were only about a mile and a half from Lake Michigan. And when you live a mile and a half from a big, beautiful, sparkling lake, and it's springtime, it's late March, and one of those great 75-degree days that suddenly come out of the hiding, and you can just feel it, and it's just vibrant. So we were coming to school on this day, just like any other day, little realizing we were about to have let's put it this way, a truly educational experience that had little to do with the geography of the Ural mountain chain, which we were studying at that time for reasons I still have not figured out. But nevertheless, we arrived at school about a minute and a half before the bell. You know, they had this bell rang at 8:25. Everybody comes charging them. And the guys are milling around out in front of the school. And it was beautiful. The sun is shining down. Well, me and Schwartz went around the back of the school. This is, again, I might point out, not a little country school. No, for any point, think of this. It had 3,000 kids. It had four stories. It covered 2.5 blocks, city blocks, gigantic school. And it is still there, operating strong. It looks exactly now as it did then. I saw it about a month ago, so don't tell me it isn't. It's there. Well, around the back of the school, we went around the back for one reason. Schwartz's homeroom and my homeroom were in the back of one of the floors. Mine was on the second floor, room 220. Schwartz was on the third floor. His was over in one wing, but near the back. See, some homerooms were in the front of the school. So we're staying around the front there for a couple of seconds, you know, and Schwartz says, what's going on in the back? So we went around the back, all the way around. We cut through the tennis courts, and there were a bunch of kids standing around in the back there, waiting to get in. We had a big door in the back there, and we milled around a little bit in the crowd there. Oh, it was a fantastic day. And the breeze was blowing, and we sort of just kind of wandered around in the crowd a little bit. And for some reason or other, I cannot tell you, you see, crime often occurs in a way that in a sense makes you believe that there is a supernatural, that you have been driven to do these things. And this is why many defendants, when they're before the dock, will finally say, I don't know why I did it. He really doesn't know why he did it. He doesn't. He's telling you the literal truth. Well, Schwartz and I drifted into, me and him were with a bunch of kids, about 12,000 kids. Hi, Cliff, you know, all that stuff. We drifted into the garage. There was a garage in the back of the school where they kept, you know, school vehicles. There was, you know, the whole lot of lawnmowers and stuff. And there was a big garage attached to the back of the school, and it was open. They had this great big door that went up, an enormous steel door that folded up, went up to the top, and all these vehicles were back there. Well, for some reason, Schwartz and I drifted into this garage. Now, why? We never drifted into that damn garage, hardly ever. But why today? It was warm. It was great. We drifted into the garage. It was kind of gloomy in there. And we were just sort of standing around back there talking. When we hear the bell, it goes. See, and all the kids go, they're roaring like hell. Schwartz and I are in the garage. Without even any previous... Well, let's put it this way. Discussion, plan, scheme, conspiracy, whatever you want to call it. I looked at Schwartz. Schwartz looked at me, and we knew we were not going into school today. We were not going into school today. So we stood there for a couple of minutes, and it's now very silent. All the kids have gone into the school. You could hear the school going on up there. You had people, you know, going up and down the halls. And Schwartz and I stood there in the darkness. And at that point, we drifted out into the concrete walkway. And along the side of the school, we turned left, past the football field, turned left again. And now we're going past. We had this big round track out there, see? And we just sort of drifted, not running. We didn't want to run or anything like that. We were walking, see. We were pretending like we were, you know, we were working at someplace. We turned right, and we ran like hell. We are free as a bird. Well, now, Schwartz had this car. He had an old car that we had spent a lot of time working on between the two of us one time or another. And we made a great big circuitous arc around the school, back all the way around to the street where Schwartz had his car parked. A lot of other kids parked there. We get into the car, we turned it around, headed away from school, and 20 minutes later, we are out at the lake. Now, we're not going to swim too early to that. Just being there, you know. We walked along, and there's big sand dunes on either side of us. We're walking along the lake. It's just fantastic. The water's lapping in. They had great beaches there, see, and the sun is coming down and dancing on the water out there, and we fooled around, and we were feeling the itch, you know, the real itch. If we only had a couple of girls here, it would be fantastic. Well, we walked down the beach, and we angled in. There was a big parking lot there, you know, it had a big bathing house and all that stuff, like Jones Beach. See? We angled in, and sure enough, there was a big restaurant there, which was being readied for the opening of the swimming season. Now, I've never told you this story because now I think the 7-year limitation has passed, and all of us can be, you know, we paid for our crime. But Schwartz and I are drifting past this big restaurant, and there were about 10 girls out there who were the girls that worked there, the waitresses and all that stuff. You know, half of them had just got out of high school. You know, some of them dropped out of high school. About 7 of them were about the same age as we were. So we start talking to these girls. And then there's a couple of the girls that said, you know, we only got a half a day today. Well, you know, why don't we go out and do something? So sure enough, the next thing you know, we are out carousing about with these two chicks. I remember one of them's name is Jane Hutchinson. I always remember this. And we're having a hell of a time. You know, we're running up and down the beach. And it was just, you know, a great moment there. And we went out and ate hot dogs, and we decided to go to a show that afternoon, which is really illicit. So we went in, we sit in there, we watched the show, and, you know, we decided that this is such a great afternoon that we're going to have to make a regular thing to see. So we talked to these two girls, and they decided, okay, how about coming next Wednesday? And this was a Wednesday. Next Wednesday, we'll get together. And, you know, we were beginning to feel the excitement. So I'm walking down the street to Schwartz after that. It's about 4 o'clock now, remember. And the kids are starting to come home from school. You can see them drifting home. All around us, the kids. Schwartz says to me, Shepard, and I said, yes, Schwartz. He says, wow. He says, you know, that door is something else, right? I said, that's right, Schwartz. I says, next time we won't be just running around on a beach, I suspect. And he says, oh, man. Hoo-wee. And you know how it is. The sap is rising. I said, listen, I said, you can have that door, but did you notice that, well, you know, that changed. And so our plans are formulating in our head. We're going to have a spring of total debauchery. We have discovered something that had never quite occurred to us. Little did we realize what was lying in wait for us. We had a great time. And so now we have joined a crowd of kids that are going home. You know, all kinds of kids. So we drive Schwartz's car down the street just like anything else, and I arrive at home. And my mother, you know, usually says, how was school today? Oh, fine. Oh, what the heck. That she had no suspicion whatsoever. And about 10 minutes later, I call Schwartz to see if it's going okay with his house. I say, Schwartz. I said, did anything happen? He says, no, she doesn't know what the hell's going on. I said, yeah, well, you know, grown-ups never know what the hell's going on, you know. So she said, okay, Schwartz. I said, no, listen, we got to figure out something for tomorrow. You know, we got to go to school tomorrow. He said, well, okay. So that night, we got together. And George says, listen, we've got to write a note. And let's write a note, and we'll figure out something. So the next day, we arrive at school. We still haven't got the damn note written. We walk into the garage. We're in the back again. We walk into the garage. Listen to this. You haven't heard a thing. We walk into the garage, and I write the note. And George says, no. That's your handwriting. You can't write that note. And there was a guy working in the garage. A mechanic. Schwartz said, say, would you write a note for us? The guy says, oh, yeah, what the hell? Sure, what do you want me to write? And Schwartz says, would you write down, Schwartz and Shepard had to stay out of school because Mrs. Schwartz needed these two boys to help her because she has arthritis and cannot wash her windows. And they helped her, signed Mrs. Schwartz. Could you write that? And he says, sure, of course. He says, but you can't. You got to put it in the first person. I had that right. So he writes it down on the hood of a Dodge truck. At which point, we grab the note. The bell rings. We go upstairs. I take it in to Miss Snyder. And she says, oh, I see. Very good, very good. And Schwartz takes the note then and gives it to his homeroom teacher, who is Miss E. McCullough. 2 periods later, I am sitting in history class. Mr. Wilson comes over to me and says, this guy called from the office. I want to talk to you. The office? Yeah, he said, I know. He just said, send you up there right away. To the first floor of the office. You know, I figured maybe they're going to ask me about why I didn't pay for the lock that I lost off my locker, you know, something like that.
sidewalk.
There's George!
Oh, my God. We are both summoned into the present. The present in this case being the principal.
He said, Mr. Marshall is down in the garage. That tells me that he wrote this note for you, too. And, you realize, of course, that Mr. Moskowitz, when he's not working in the garage, works for us here in the truant department. He spends his time.
My God, a fink! Of all the people!
We were suspended for 3 days. There was a note sent home to my mother, not by me, but mailed to my mother. A triplicate was sent to Miss Snyder, my homeroom teacher. It was probably also sent to the FBI.
And from that day on, Schwartz and I were assigned for the next 2 weeks. After school, every day, with a pail and a can of Bon Ami, to wash the walls of the lobby to the auditorium. We washed and we washed. Schwartz said nothing, I said nothing. We never even mentioned it, my captain, eh? We didn't get to the beach much either. That. Never did see Jane Hudson again. I don't know what the hell happened to Doris. But all I know, the fear of getting caught has never left me. Never left me.
Yeah. This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for our conversation, okay?